This is Greta Trich-Roman here with Dan Roop at his home in Hudson, New York on July 3rd, 2017. I'm interviewing Dan as a part of the Oral History Summer School. Dan, can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Well, hello. my name is Dan Roop. I'm an artist here in Hudson, painter primarily. Moved here in 2000. From California. I paint people, places, and things, and do anything that releases my creative energy that sort of guides me in my life.
Can you tell me a little bit about where you come from?
I was born in Northern Indiana. My family is Mennonite, and I stress that over and over again throughout my life, that I have a lot of respect for the Mennonites, that we are non-aggressive people and very inclusive of people rather than exclusive. And I was raised in the country. I remember in the summer being awakened at 5 o'clock in the morning to go pick strawberries until it got too hot, and then we were fed breakfast. Sounds like torture, but it has me today getting up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and working. Not a bad thing. I've been an artist all my life. I'm turning 65 this year. My first art teacher, where I was constantly aware that I was doing quote-unquote art, was when I was 5 years old, and made my commitment to being an artist when I was 16. And then it was like a domino effect of love, things happening. Being raised very sheltered in the Mennonite church and out in the country. I suppose that started to unravel a little bit. At 17, I went to a private art school, high school, for my last year, 2 years of high school. And flowered in a lot of ways. I was considered one of the kings of the art department very quickly. And am I compulsive? Yes. Am I do I compete as an artist? I want to say no, but that's probably not true. I always want to do my best. And made my commitment to be an artist when I was 16. And coming out of the closet sexually at 17. And taking a stance on my spirituality, that it wasn't confined to Christianity, was when I was 17. That was 1969, and it seemed like a lot of things were exploding in this country, and I was doing my own exploding in Indiana. I have lived in many places. I went to school on the East Coast. I lived in the Midwest, lived in Chicago, moved to Northern Wisconsin, lived on Cape Cod, moved to Los Angeles, and then I moved here, and in amongst those times, I've been to Mexico, I've been to Nepal, I taught down the Dominican Republic. The world's a beautiful place. It's a privilege to be living. And I do believe that one has to fight to be alive. Not fight with other people, but fight to get out of your own way to have your life. As an artist, the hardest thing about doing art is, there again, to get out of your own way. That art is very simple. It requires you to pay attention and to, for me, to give it over to my higher power, that I'm not doing it alone, and that my hands are guided by by something greater than myself. I was talking to another artist today, Kenny Blansky, and he's the same age as I am, and we pretty much said the same thing at the same time, that it is a miracle and it is the gift that still we are so interested in doing our art. And it is as challenging to me as it was when I was a teenager. The only difference is, from when I was a teenager and where I am now, is that I have more options. And also know better on what is not true. I talk to people about the jibber jabber. What is that? The critics, the debate team in their head, that tells you what you should do and what you shouldn't do, and most of that is garbage. I believe in being alive and celebrating life and joy, and I'm attracted to what's bright and shiny. I want people to feel good from my work. I don't want my work to be nice, but I want it to be supportive in living our life well, joyously. When I pray to my God, it's usually my saying, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I'm saying that every time I see a sunset. Every time I just slow down enough to absorb what's around me and look on what's right in the world rather than what's wrong in the world. Because in reality, what's wrong in the world is what's advertised to us. And we already know that. We already know what's wrong in the world. But we miss out on what's right in the world. because it gets overshadowed by everything that's that in our minds. We figure that we had the wrong president, or the wrong countries were at war with us, or my bank account isn't saying what I wanted to say. I don't have the right man. And all that is incidental. That what's right with us has to be right from our core. That's an extended answer. I'm going through everything I own this summer because I'm moving to Athens by the end of the summer. And I'm downsizing. I brought everything that I own into this house in 05. That was in storage in Indiana, here in Hudson, in Wisconsin, California. It all came here. And what I realized from that and when right at this moment, that my compulsivity is abundant here, that I have more than what I need. And all I want to do is paint and draw and experience the day, whatever that day may be. When I was talking to Kenny earlier today, that being an artist, we have to recreate ourselves every time we sit down to paint. That we have to get out of our own way to enable us to do that. I think God speaks to me through my working, my doing my art. And I don't know, can't really quite predict what that's going to be, what those words are going to be. When I lived in Provincetown in the 90s, I was referred to as the power line queen, because I seem to always include power lines in my paintings. And that is still so true, that I still have my attraction to power lines. And I know people's reaction to them is how ugly they are. But I don't see them as too bad. The reality is that they're there, and to me they slice up the sky. They create a special quality in a painting that excites me. As I said, I've been going through everything I own. And recently I went through my flat files and looked at art that I have done since I was a child. And yes, I think I showed promise when I was in my single digit ages. But it wasn't until I hit 16 that something started to develop in my work, a depth. And I must admit, I didn't throw away so much of my old work once I hit 16. except for figure drawings and on newsprint, and it's sort of like doing the scales on the piano, that you do it over and over and over again, so that it is a spontaneous compulsion on the page. I like me. It really surprises me to say that. But through going through all my work, I like my thinking, my humor. I taught 4 months in a week in the Dominican Republic back in 96. And for the first 2.5 months, I painted feverishly and taught, and that's all I really did. Again to the country, tropics, the tarantulas, and then I had I was involved in the Arts and Residency show, and sold probably half my work, and some of it was very large. I feel like I did my duty, and did it well, and I was teaching well. My students liked me, and I was getting results from them. I was teaching figure drawing and plein air painting, and that was exciting. And I started acquiring models on my own because I could afford it, and they didn't cost very much. And it was mostly men, and I did a whole series of, for that last month and a half, homoerotic drawings. And the context of it was an experiment of if I posed them like porno, would it be pornography that I'm drawing? And I was very moved by the results, and also realizing I can't get involved sexually while I'm working, because that comes from a whole different place in my head, and I feel like I've been wrenched around. I also realized from going through that work and other works of mine that I must have thrown out a good third of it because it wasn't bold enough. I had a teacher say to me that you have to be able to read the image from across the room when, so make it show up on the page. And some of those naked guys just didn't show up on the page. I don't know exactly what I'm going to be doing as far as in my work in Athens. But I'm also not very worried about that. My favorite faction of the human race, even though I'm a gay man, are older women. And I'm almost the only guy in my building, in my new place. And so I'm surrounded by older ladies. I'll probably be painting some of them. Painting the streets of Athens, the river over there. I'll leave myself open. After all, life is a journey, and not knowing exactly what's going to happen next is usually how the day goes. I'll be doing a little more traveling once I get out of this house. I've been invited to New Mexico, been invited back to California, to Oregon. I'll make some trips out west. I'll make some trips back to the Midwest. And I'm invited down to Florida. Maybe I'll save that for sometime in the winter. Florida has a very large pool. It should be fixed by then.
I have so many questions. You've talked about so many fascinating things. I wonder if we can return for just a minute and maybe tell me a little bit more about you. You're talking about your coming of age at 16 and 17. And can you tell me a little bit more about that? And you use the word exploding.
Well, I always thought of myself as quiet. Maybe I wasn't so quiet. My mother was a singer, church music primarily, and classical music, and she was a very fine soprano. Of course, all us children had to be taught in voice and in other musical instruments. I put down my instruments at 16 because I realized that I was practicing for hours daily, plus doing my art, visual arts, and then I really had to make a choice here. What did I love most? And I love music very much. Love listening to it. Yeah, I even love performing it when I was a child. But at 16, I made a stance that music, that is going to be painting and drawing and sculpture, whatever visual medium I work in, was more important to me than music, because music, I wasn't that deep. People have often said, "Oh, you're so talented," and it's a word I heard all my life. And as I got older, what I realized is that, okay, maybe I'm talented, but I'm interested. So if someone's interested in their work, they become talented in it. Even when they show no sign of talent at the beginning. There's a girl in my high school class at Interlochen. And she was nice. But everybody thought her work was bad. And like I saw no hope for her. But I'll tell you, I saw her bloom. And she bloomed because she was interested in what she was doing. She paid attention. She was there for it. And so my premise of art is that anyone can do this. They have to be interested and believe that they can. That they can believe that they can get out of their own way to do it. My level of expertise in how I paint a purse or Marilyn Monroe or a landscape shows up when I do it. That is secondary to the aliveness that goes on in it, even when I can't do it properly. In reviewing all these drawings and little paintings in my flat file on what's going and what's not, what I'm saving and what I'm letting go, it really is based on, is this piece alive? Not, is it correct? But is it alive? Does it have feeling? Does it keep me engaged and wanting to be with it? So that's why I say anyone can do what I do. Their way. But there was a time I had a gay uncle, Uncle Ralph, and it was around the time when Monet was having major exhibitions in Manhattan, which went across the country, and I saw that in Chicago. And it was an amazing exposition. It was very moving, very, very moving in my doing my landscapes that I was involved in. And I was living in Indiana then. I think it's very important to show your work, because that is your clearest language. That as an artist, that is our main language, and yes, I wanted to paint like Monet. I wanted to get that light quality, that soft brush stroke. And I achieved it. And that was in 79, beginning of 80. And that was called John Winger's Pond, that series of work. And my work changed a lot after that. Because I realized that I was painting the way my mother wanted me to paint. And I really didn't pick that up until that moment. That it had to look real. It had to be like sharp focus realism. And I'm not that stiff now that things can loosen up a little bit. As I said, I want the work to look alive. And that says something. I mean, I teach a senior painting class over at the Senior Center, and that's been going on since last fall. And at that time, I was working with a place called the Second Show, which is the hospital resale shop. And I hold them as family. I really love those people over there. And I put this by them. I said, could I borrow stuff from your store for my students to paint it, the paintings of it? And they put by me that they wanted me to put my work in the windows. And I said, how about me and my class? So we'll be painting your products. And you can put the products and the paintings side by side. And that's what we did, and it was a successful show. It also... I imagine it supported my students feeling that what they were doing was valid, and it was. I especially liked when I painted that big black lacy bra, and somehow the $5 price tag on it says it all.
Can you describe the painting that you're pointing at over here?
Well, sure. My big black racy bra is the it's showing purple, black, blue, see through with density of material on the cups of the bra, and it's so sculptural because it's not a wad of fabric on the floor, but it's upright, and I'm proud of my bra. It sort of reminds me of the pocketbook too, where it's so upright and present. I believe that anything is paintable in the right context. It has to have the interest of the artist, of course, but of the viewer for it to be successful. Nudes, male or female, drawings or paintings or sculpture or whatever it is made out of, is all valid stuff if it reads, if as an audience that I'm looking at the work, if I want to continue to look at it, then it's successful. No matter who did it or how it's done. It's not just because it's a naked person that makes it right. That's just incidental. Especially very old fashioned. I get very attached to things. And that's probably one of the hard things about downsizing. I donated a piece that I designed. That was my mother's hutch it's sort of Danish modern meets China. I don't know. It's a 7 foot tall china cupboard that has made out of cherry and filled back maple, and I donated that to Restore. And it's an exciting piece. I even signed the back of it because I did design it. And can we pause for a moment?
Yes, exactly. So you were just talking about how you become attached to things, and you were talking about your mother's touch.
Yeah, I remember where I was going. The hutch left the house, and it's very heavy, and it took a lot of man and woman power to get it out of the house. And all that was well and good. But it was the next day of it not being around that it just was like a big blank space in my life without it. And I've been living with that hutch in my environment since 2005, and I designed it for my mother in 98. She had it built in Indiana, and it worked. It really worked for her, and it worked for me here. So I miss it, the grain, the glitter of the glass, the rattling of the doors when I walked by. But that just shows me up as you know, I mourn for it to leave, but I'm glad it's out in the world. Something else that I'm going to probably react even stronger is I had a foster brother named Darko, and he was remarkable. He was so much not like the rest of my family. He was born in Austria. 7 years older than me. He seemed so worldly and handsome and not Mennonite. Smoked, drank, had many women. I loved him. And he made a giant Kon-Tiki-like head when he was a senior in high school. That was in the 60s. And that was always on my parents' mantle. He died in 03, and I inherited it. And that thing is a good 3.5-4 feet tall and weighs about 300 pounds. And I know I don't have a place for it in my next place. So I don't know where it will go. And I have another friend who's been a friend of mine since the mid-70s, who's always thought of that Kon-Tiki head as really vulgar and ugly. I suppose it is, but I'm going to miss that thing. And but I also know that I will adapt, because that's what life is about.
So you're just telling me about the sculpture over here that your foster brother had made.
Yeah, I don't know where it's going to go to be sold. I don't want it to go to the dump. I suppose if I have to, I will embody it in resin and stick it outside my front my back door of where I'm moving to in Athens if I can't find a home for it. But that's not the biggest priority right now. My priority right now is my trust that God is guiding me in what I'm doing. And not to be afraid. In my teaching, I let my students know that it's okay to be afraid, that I'm afraid every time I sit down to paint of not being good enough. And I know that it's a lie. That's what I refer to as jibber jabber. Noise in your head. That I really have trust that God's taking me down a street that I hadn't been on before, and that I'm going to be okay, even if the pain turns out bad. Because what the reality is, if I don't paint, I'm in trouble. If I paint bad, I just pick up the brush again. I have to trust my first thought. And that's why I tell my students that's usually the correct thought. That I had a teacher say to me, Dan, just take that brush and put it onto the canvas. And yes, it's going to be a wrong stroke, but you can correct it. And it is. You can correction, 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 correction. And that's what painting is about. In the doing of it. I haven't been painting that much because I've been so involved in packing and moving. But I squeeze in painting here and there. And I just recently finished a painting that I started it feels like 2 months ago. And I usually get a painting done in a day or so. And it was partially because of the weather and partially because of being so busy packing, moving, selling, keeping up with my commitments, being responsible. But I finished it and I feel very good about it. But leaves a hole for me to do another one. And what's difficult is that at this point, if I don't have it here, it's over in Athens, and I don't have a vehicle yet. And I won't be in a car until the beginning of September. And I really require the generosity of friends in order for me to meet my obligations to do what I need to do as an artist. I keep pencil and paper at hand that I can at least sketch. I really have to stay in the context that no excuse is good enough for me not to do art. And any excuse for me not to do art is a lie. That's why I'm here. I mean, that's why I'm still alive. That there's too many times in my life that I should have died. What kept me alive is my curiosity on what the next painting, next drawing, next image was going to be. I came across a pair of glasses. I wear glasses. And these glasses were just paper that I to tape onto my real glasses so I can still see, but be sort of in costume. And it was just sort of like a black line across my eyes. And how I could see through the paper was these little slits. And that was back in Devo time. Back in the mid-70s. And where I would wear tight ankled skinny pants when I was skinny, and I was skinny then as well, and very tailored jacket and you know, very simple clothing, tiny tie. That I sort of looked like a person who had no personality because of the black line across my eyes. It was a good costume, and to come across that those tape on glasses supports me today. Whatever I have to do to show myself my creative self, that's my job. And that has always been my job. You were asking a question of how in my mid-teen life, and I was exploding. I came out of the closet when I was 17 on Thanksgiving to my family. Surprisingly, no one was aware of it. Maybe my brother was, but he hasn't talked to me then or now much. When I was 16, 17 years old, I was making my commitment to be an artist. I was making a commitment on who I was sexually, on what I wanted in my life. And now I'm 65, well, in September. And I'm reviewing how I've done. I think I have many friends, like a lot of people, and probably some people I shouldn't be so friendly with. I want to see the good in people. I am living my life with everyone, living their lives. And that's a privilege. And for them to like me and want me around, whether they're gay or straight, conservative or liberal, seems incidental. 'Cause truth is, I like people who are liberal and conservative and wild and the mirror. I just want people to show up for life. I want me to show up for life. You know, I know that but what I'm saying is true, as long as I don't sound like a Baptist preacher. Not to say anything wrong with Baptists, but my experience of Baptist ministers and their hellfire and brimstone and the drama that I witnessed in churches. Oh, pardon me.
Recording. So you were just talking about you didn't want to sound like a Baptist minister, but...
No, I don't want... that Baptist ministers have a way of making me wrong, and they are right. And that isn't the premise that I want to be with anybody. We're both... besides that, we were in the same room together and having a conversation. That is a privilege, and that's right from the beginning. And I want to keep myself open so I can look at clouds and see horses and dogs instead of clouds. And today is very vivid. So, have I done drugs? Yes. Am I sorry I did them? No. Do I want to do them now? No. I am grateful that I am in sobriety. I'm very grateful that I have some sane lines of thought, and I don't want to put anything in the way of my spiritual experience, and my spiritual experience is my creating, and my downsizing and moving to Athens is about that. Which I hope that also includes my painting on the road and just pulling on the side and start painting in a state I don't know, and trusting that I'm gonna be okay, because I usually am. Thank you.
Did you have anything else you wanted to bring up for today?
The weather's beautiful today.
It is beautiful today. Thank you, Dan, so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.